now tuned into the Pod Awful Channel. Pod Awful.
Bi-quarterly women's social club.
Dazed and convicted.
Pool party radio.
The devil's advocate.
The projection booth.
Awful flicks. PodAwful.net.
I blast my head control of your TV set. Are you receiving me?
Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
It was a New York phenomenon. It was to gays what Deep Throat was to straights. But there were as many women, really, as there were men, couples and everything, because it had become very mainstream, very odd phenomenon.
Oh, it was all over New York. I mean, everybody in New York. It was in the papers and stuff like that.
So. I don't remember any of that. It wasn't all over my part of New York. I don't know. But it didn't... It was, oh, really? Well, I hope he made a lot of money out of the porn film.
It was in the trade papers and stuff.
One of our dates, I have to go back a little bit, was I took Roger to see Boys in the Band, the play. And down the line, we hear, did you know Wake has done a movie called Boys in the Sand? And we were like, oh, God, that sounds great. That's so cool. Boys in the Sand, doesn't that sound good? You want to go see it? So we went to see it.
And I think it gave the audiences, made them comfortable about going to see something. There was a certain amount of respectability around it that made it okay to just be adventurous and go see what he was up to, what this picture was all about.
And it was a little bit different than we expected. But I thought it was great. And Roger was like a little more... laid back about it.
I was. I mean, we sat on the third row over to the side, and it was boys in the sand, boys in the aisles, boys everywhere.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is my stalwart cohort, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Sun sanded skin, it's a beautiful thing.
Also joining us this week is writer and filmmaker Jim Tuschinski.
Greetings, folks.
This week we are discussing Boys in the Sand, the 1971 landmark film from director Wakefield Poole. The film was one of the first adult films to find crossover success into more mainstream audiences, preceding Deep Throat's success. What's more remarkable is that the film is a gay erotica motion picture that came out a mere year and a half after the Stonewall riots. The film consists of three sections, presented without dialogue and with a classical musical score. Our guest co-host this week, Jim Tuschinski, directed a documentary about director Wakefield Poole called I Always Said Yes, The Many Lives of Wakefield Poole, and I'm sure we'll be talking a lot about that film as we go along. But first, I wanted to ask you, when did you first see Boys in the Sand, and what was your initial impression, sir?
You know, I don't know exactly when I saw it first. I certainly knew about it for years before I saw it. I had actually seen Wakefield's film Bijou first. And then I guess I must have seen Boys in the Sand. It was probably in the 80s sometime on VHS. It might have been even as late as the early 90s. I don't really remember when I first saw it, actually. It's just always sort of been there.
Tell me about when you first saw Bijou, then.
Oh, my God. I was blown away. For those of you who don't know, there's a big difference between Boys in the Sand and Bijou. Boys in the Sand is very... vanilla, let's say. Very, you know, lots of sunshine, gorgeous houses, beautiful scenery, beautiful men. Bijou is a dark, sort of psychedelic Rorschach test, really. It entirely depends on your mood and what your psychology is. That will determine what you get out of the film, because it's so open-ended and enigmatic and just gorgeous to look at. So it's a very different movie, and I just was blown away by Bijou. I thought, oh my God, this is the sort of thing I love. It's dark, twisted, sexy, but it isn't traditional porn. It's like a half an hour before there's any sex at all. That was what really got me excited. And then I went back and saw Boys in the Sand just because you had to. It was like this historic film that people had talked about. So I knew I needed to see that at some point.
Well, I've seen Boys in the Sand and Bijou, and we'll get more into that in a bit. But how it came onto my radar was, as you know, on the show, I was a supporter of the restoration of the opening of Misty Beethoven, which Stephen at DistribPix was doing. And either in the commentary or in the documentaries, there was this discussion on Casey Donovan, who is in opening Misty Beethoven. And someone said something about, well, he was in this film in 1971 called Boys in the Sand. It was very important. And I had, you know, I'm not, you know, even though I did work in a video store that had a large adult section, and I also worked in a bookstore that had a decent sized adult section as well, wasn't really familiar with the film. I think part of it had to do with the fact that I hadn't watched a lot of gay film, and specifically of that era. So when I heard that, or saw that in the opening of Misty Beethoven extras, I was like, God, I don't look this up. So I looked it up and was totally blown away by the fact that here was a film that came out in 1971. It was a crossover success. I mean, meaning that they had ads in the New York Times. They had actual reviews from Variety and other places. There were celebrities that came out to see it. And I said, where does that sound familiar? Oh, a year later with Deep Throat. So maybe, you know, looking at the history, and now as we'll discuss going forward in the show, and you'll also hear from Mr. Poole himself, that is indeed the case, that this film was actually the one that sort of helped set the track for what Deep Throat would do and all of that stuff that would come after when we talk about sort of the mainstream of what a film became in the early to mid 1970s. And it's fascinating to view it through that lens. I think even if you I know that we had a few people on Facebook and things like that go, well, I think I'm going to skip that episode because, you know, I'm a straight guy. Why do I care about this gay film? Well, I think the history of this alone, even if you don't find gay sex on film exciting to you, is definitely worth your time and learning about this whole history of Wakefield Pool, and especially what Jim has done with the documentary. It's quite amazing.
I first ran across Wakefield Pool's name years and years ago. It might have been in Film as a Subversive Art, but I read about Bible first and really kind of got a bee in my bonnet about Bible, because I'm a big fan of kind of subversive erotica when it comes to retelling or reinterpreting biblical stories through an erotic lens. You know, things like Him or I Saw Jesus Die or any of these, because there's just a ton of, well, not a ton, but there are certainly quite a few erotic films that have a religious angle to them, let's say, and read about Bible and then read about Wakefield, picked up his book, Dirty Pool, read about his films, but I don't know, this must have been pre-internet or something, because I had really no idea where I was going to find these movies. Finding heterosexual porn was difficult enough for me at this time. Finding gay porn, it was like a whole other world. So there was no way I was going to be able to find where these were. And then as time went on, I found that Bible just was not available whatsoever. It was one of these, you know, like holy grail of films for me for a long, long time. And then I started to get back into his work. And I think it was through you, Rob, you had brought this up. And I said, oh, I read this guy's book. I know who Wakefield Pool is. Okay. And then tracked down Jim and got to talking to him. And then when I found out that Jim was doing this documentary, it's like, wow, you know, all the stars just aligned in the right way. So finally, I was able to see Bible. I was able to see Boys in the Sand, and I was able to see Bijou, and totally blew me away. I have to say, just like you, Jim, Bijou really put the zap on me. I think that Boys in the Sand is so important historically that we kind of, when we decided what we would, you know, focus on with this episode, that we said, okay, that one really deserves a spotlight, but Bijou, as far as entertainment value and what it does for my head when I watch it, it's like, yeah, that's the one where it's at. Because Boys in the Sand, though it is such a groundbreaking film, and it's very visually striking, I have to give it that, it isn't as far out and in that sweet spot for me where Bijou is as far as the way that the story is being told. And I think it's really just an evolution of a filmmaker, because you get see such a giant leap with each one of these films.
I couldn't agree more. And the reason that Boys in the Sand fascinates me is its history and what it did, how it opened sexuality up for a huge number of people at a time when it was just really starting. People were just starting to question sex and sexuality, and could it be part of popular entertainment? How would it be part? Could we actually see sex on screen? Oh my God! It was, this stuff had not been done before. There was porn, but it wasn't in the same way. And even the porn then, Boys in the Sand, Bijou, Deep Throat, Opening Misty Beethoven, anything from the porno chic era is not the same thing as porn today. And I think it's important that people understand that. This is very different stuff. And Boys in the Sand is very much of its time and of its moment. And once you understand what it did and what it stood for, I think you look at it in a very different way than if you just watch it as, oh yeah, it's this, it's a really important gay film. And everybody kind of leaves going, well, wow, that was it? Really? Because now we're so used to it. We're so used to the way porn is and what it is. And, it's not supposed to have story. It's not supposed to be take its time to get to the sex. Nowadays, it's sex right away. That didn't happen in the 70s very much, especially with the stuff that people went to see and that did very, very well was porno chic.
So I won't pretend to be any sort of historical expert on porn or erotica or whatsoever. When I think about erotica at that time and earlier, I think about things like the Nudie Cuties, and I think about the Loops. I think about, the kind of underground when it comes to all this stuff. What was that world like when it came to gay erotica? What was that like? I mean, it wasn't just, because what we see, when I watch something like a Before Stonewall or something, it's a lot of, guys doing muscle poses, yeah. And it's maybe the films of Kenneth Anger, but what was that world like for people?
Well, it was very sleazy, for one thing. You didn't go see gay porn to watch a movie. You snuck in, the theaters were dirty, gross, they had the lights on during the films, because they didn't want people to be, touching each other. So the joke was that you would go to these porn theaters, the gay porn theaters. There were only, I think, two in New York, actually. And you could read the New York Times, no problem, because they kept the lights on so high. There was always a chance you would get busted. And the films they were showing were loops, basically, 10-minute, usually without sound, but they would play whatever music they had during the screening. And Wakefield, tells a wonderful story about, which is probably in the interview that you did with him, about how the whole idea of Boys in the Sand came about by watching one of these really awful porn movies with a bunch of friends one night. It was not a pleasant experience. The men in the films looked a little sleazy, worn out. The stories, the situations were pretty much, the pizza boy and the surfer dude, and it made you feel kind of dirty going to see it. Straight films weren't that different at the time either. It was a lot of Grindhouse and Loops and Beavers and Beaver Shorts and things like that. So it's a very different world from what people think about today when they think about going watching porn.
When you talk about those early loops and those early films, and in the interview with Wakefield, he does talk about it a little bit, just sort of being turned off by this sort of sleaze factor. Do you think that it was a cultural issue, that there was a lot of shame involved in sexuality, be it straight or gay, and that's just sort of what came out of into the camera and out of the lens of the projector kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that was some of it. But also, you have to look at, who was making this stuff. Now, people are going to jump on me, and they usually do, about the people who know a lot about the history of a gay porn, for example, there were other filmmakers around the same time as Wakefield who were doing really interesting things, primarily on the West Coast. It all kind of happened at the same time. They, however, didn't get the sort of mainstream success that Wakefield did until a little bit later. While there were people making interesting experimental kinds of things, most of the loops were being done to provide fodder for these really sleazy gay theaters, all of which were owned by the mob. So, you know, you had somebody say, okay, well, I need a loop and, you know, go out and make it. Here's $100. Go, you know, find some sleazy hooker, some rent boy, and go to a motel room and shoot it. So I think a lot of it was just that, yeah, there was shame. There was also – there were no depictions of beautiful men having sex and liking it. In the loops, there was a lot of, you know, people holding knives to their throats or, you know, rape fantasies, this kind of stuff. It wasn't romantic. It didn't feel like sex was okay. I think that was probably similar for straight porn at the time, too, where it was just sort of naughty. You weren't supposed to be seeing it. You weren't supposed to be going to these theaters and watching this.
And that's the thing that I really like about Boys in the Sand, you know, watching it. It is. It does have the feel that, okay, these are loops because it's dealing with some of the same conventions. It's silent. They just seem like longer loop sections. And really, just to give people an idea of what the film is, it's three pieces, really. The first one is on the beach. It's actually, I guess, Wakefield's lover at the time, Peter, and Casey Donovan, who comes out of the surf, and they have a scene together. And then there's the second scene is sort of poolside. There's one guy and Casey Donovan again. And then the third scene is Casey Donovan. He's in this house and another guy. And then it's basically all three of these scenes together. But the thing that I find interesting about all these scenes and sort of how it plays together is that when I was thinking about it back a few days after I watched it, is that those scenes unto themselves, even though they are sex scenes and things like that, there really is kind of a narrative that plays between those three scenes that carries through the entire piece. What I kind of saw was in the beginning sort of, you know, Casey Donovan coming out of the surf. And then by the end, by the third piece, it's about maybe the fantasy having a fantasy of his own. And the idea that maybe in the first sequence, at least my reading of it, he is the fantasy man. And by the last one, he's thinking of what would be a fantasy for him. So it's kind of interesting kind of how this, you know, over this about 90 minutes, how everything kind of moves.
Oh, not even 90 minutes. It actually runs 70 some minutes because that was what he knew they needed at least a little over 60 minutes, hopefully 70 minutes to have a feature film. So he really, you know, he had set his sights on making a feature. And that had to be 70 minutes. So it's about 72 minutes, I think. So it actually goes by really quickly. But you're absolutely right. There is a narrative between the three. Linda Williams, the film professor at Berkeley, who has written several wonderful books about pornography, particularly hardcore, is one of hers. And Screening Sex is the other one. She does a really long analysis of Boys in the Sand, talking about how the different parts look at different ways that gay men relate to each other. The second one, for example, is all about having a relationship and having a boyfriend, because Casey writes away to the gay magazine, gets a pill in the mail. He throws it in the pool. Suddenly this beautiful Italian man appears, and that becomes his lover. In the first one, it's very much about a fantasy of somebody coming out of the sea and being like the perfect lover for you. The third one is also a fantasy, but it's more along the lines of fantasy becoming reality by the end. So it's a really interesting analysis that she does, talking about what these different things would mean. Of course, Wakefield didn't think of any of this when he made it. He just made it. He knew what he wanted. That's what he did. He pointed the camera at people who wanted to have sex with each other, and that, I think, was the important thing for him. He wanted people who wanted each other and had not had sex before, so that he could actually show them having sex for real. And that's what really comes across in Boys in the Sand. And it's funny screening it now for people who are not used to watching porno in a theater with other people. It's a very difficult experience for them, for the most part. But what happens is this has happened to me several times when I've been at screenings where we've shown it, and younger people will come up to me and say, you know what? This is the first time I've ever seen porn where the guys actually looked like they were enjoying it, that it wasn't a job for them, that there was actual passion between them. And I think that's what sets it apart, is it just – it feels very authentic. Even if it's using fantasy in some of its storytelling, it feels very authentic. These people are having sex with each other and really enjoying it.
The other thing that I find interesting, and this is what you were talking about, obviously viewing it with younger people, is the focus is not as much as what you would expect on the orgasm, mm-hmm. you know, and specifically considering that it's okay. Oh, it's men. It doesn't matter if you're straight or gay. It's all about that. Right. But with this, it's like you were talking about Bijou, where it takes 30 minutes before you ever get to that point, wherever you get to a sex scene. With this, it's like everything builds and it's very slow and it's deliberate and it's very intimate in that way, as you were saying. And to me, I almost kind of felt like as I was watching it that it has these elements of like classical art. You know, when we talk about maybe like David you know, classical nudes and things like that. I mean, it's just very beautifully presented in terms of the body, but it's not presented in that fetish kind of way that I see most modern porn today.
Both Wakefield and Peter, his lover, were very into art at the time. They were, you know, they collected modern art, but they would also go to museums. And Peter was really the art hound, and he taught Wakefield everything about art and what was good visually, what wasn't good visually. So I think you're right. There's a lot of that in there.
There really isn't that kind of fetishization. I mean, we get loving, very nice, lingering kind of shots on the bodies and everything, but there isn't that look at how big this guy's cock is kind of long shots where you just stay on the sex organs. It's more about the entire body and about where they're at physically as well as with their heads, rather than just the sex organs. And, you know, Jim, you had talked about how sleazy the early films were. And one of the things that I like about Boys in the Sand is that there is none of that sleaze, and just having it all in, you know, in the broad daylight is just so wonderful that you get to see everything in this beautiful lighting, you know, just out there among nature, at least with the first sequence. You know, it's really nice to see that kind of openness in every way.
Yeah, and that had never been done before for gay sex on the screen, and probably not a whole lot for straight sex at the time either. But I mean, that's what made it so revolutionary, was people would go and see this film and go, oh my God, you know, this sex is beautiful. I think I can come out now. You know, that sounds really silly, but Wakefield got so many stories from people who said, I went to see Boys in the Sand and I realized I could come out now because it was okay. Straight people went to see it because it was the thing to do, particularly in New York. And many of them saw gay sex for the first time ever, and it was presented as something beautiful. That was revolutionary at the time. It just wasn't done. And Wakefield didn't – I mean, he set out to make a beautiful porn film is what he says, but he really didn't think anybody would see it. He thought it would be just, you know, a quick thing. And because he was kind of well-known being in the theater at the time – his friends would come, and that would be about it. They really didn't expect the enormous success that it was.
The thing that I find funny is when you hear other directors or other artists talk about the possibility of making porn film. And I remember John Waters said once that to him, making porn was like shooting open heart surgery. And that this is so not like that. I mean, that is such a modern convention that it's become cliche, and it's very sad. I mean, that's why I think Mike and I on the show have focused a lot. When we talk about adult film, we focus on things like Misty Beethoven, like Devil and Miss Jones, and all of that stuff, because that was the stuff that, as I always talked about, where the sex didn't stop the film, because there are adult films where you have a narrative, the sex starts, it's like, we got to take a break for 15 minutes and then we go back to the plot. And with things like this, both with Boys in the Sand and with Bijou, he's able to integrate all of this in and make it work and make it flow in such a way that it's beautiful to watch, and it doesn't feel tedious. Like I was saying, I mean, if you're a straight guy and you're watching it, it doesn't feel tedious. It's like, oh, when is this going to end? You know, or even if you are gay, you know, like how I feel about sometimes when I'm watching modern adult film, I'm like, oh, man, this is horrible. You know, it's like either I want to watch just a short snippet of that because that's all I want, or I want something that's really well integrated. And I think he just does a masterful job in both Boys in the Sand and Beat You.
It's interesting because some audiences are really they find Boys in the Sand to be a bit tedious because there's a lot of walking, for example. Everybody seems to be doing a lot of walking. And there's a lot of the scenery and the setup for the sex. And folks these days, particularly, you know, people who are in their 20s and 30s who see it, aren't used to this at all. It's like, well, wait a minute. When I thought this was supposed to be porn. What's going on? This is kind of dull. It is, in a way, if that's what you're looking for. If you're looking for porn, you know, to get off, probably isn't going to work so well with Boys in the Sand or Bijou. Although, I don't know, Bijou still gets me all hot and bothered. I can't help it. But it's strange. They're very much of their time. I would like to think that once people have context around that time and what these films are, it makes them more palatable. It makes them easier to watch. I don't know. I mean, to me, I enjoy watching them just because I do know so much about what's going on and what's happened in the making of them and how they came about. So I'm maybe not such a good person to say whether or not they work today or not.
Yeah, I would put Bijou right alongside some of my other favorite kind of theatrical porn, such as Behind the Green Door or Cafe Flesh, this whole idea of going to a theater and having this kind of theatrical experience, whether the main character is on a stage, part of the program, or watching the program, kind of filling in as the viewer in that case. I'm right there with it. And that one really did keep my interest very much while I was watching it. And it was just it's a trip. I mean, it is very fascinating to see the way that the story progresses.
What's cool about Bijou is it raises more questions than it answers. By the time you're done with it, you're like, well, wait a minute. If this was supposed to be a club for women, how did he end up there? And how did they know? You know, and did that woman really die from the car wreck, but she shows up in the film later? What's going on here? I think it still works really well today. And I've seen it with audiences, most particularly at the Berlin Porn Film Festival, which did a retrospective of Wake's work last year. Watching the audience watching Bijou was just amazing. They were right with it every step of the way. It was great. It was the best audience experience I've seen with Bijou. You know, Boys in the Sand, they were kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, this is all right. Bible, they adored. Take One, they adored. Moving was probably a little less adored. But it's just crazy to watch them with an audience these days because they just don't know how to react.
There's so much visual richness to it. And the thing that I was thinking about with both of them, although, as you were saying, you know, Boys in the Sand isn't as visually rich and over the top. As you were saying, it gets kind of psychedelic and crazy a bit times at Bijou, but it works really well, is, Mike, you had brought up earlier, Kenneth Anger. And when I was watching it, I was thinking, you know, these are two guys that are about the same age, probably had similar references, you know, both being sort of gay men and things like that, and having those kind of references to old Hollywood, to, you know, Broadway, stage and screen, things like that. And I just kind of felt a kinship between those two, although, of course, Anger is much more into the occult and odd symbolism at times than what Wakefield Poole does with Bijou. But to me, they almost seem like connected in some way.
Well, sometimes I feel like there's almost a self-loathing when it comes to Anger's work. Like sometimes it feels like his characters being punished for their desires. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but with Wake stuff, it feels like there's much more of a celebration of desires than a shame.
I would say that's definitely true with Fireworks, but you also have to consider Fireworks is 1947. So, but there are aspects of the triumph, you know, in fireworks. He does get punished, but in the end prevails. So there's this murkiness to it as well, where you're kind of left questioning. And that was the thing. I was thinking more of the later period, the stuff that he was doing in the 60s. Just, you know, as we were talking about, with sort of visually rich images, you know, multiple images, visual impositions, things like that.
I think Kenneth Anger and Wakefield Pool are similar in some ways, but visually, yeah, you're right. They do come from that. I mean, Wake was raised on the movies. He knows everything about movies. He watches movies constantly. Between movies and Broadway musicals, you know, that's Wakefield's main brainscape when he was making those early films. So I think that really comes through. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, we're going to take a break and play an interview with the director of Boys in the Sand after these important messages.
Life's complicated. That's why Dazed and Convicted has health and lifestyle tips to really help you with those day-to-day dilemmas.
The only way to stop the itching and burning and sedate the empty feeling is to wear a butt plug for an hour.
Plus relationship hints.
You know, Rafe tells a gal all she needs to know about a guy.
Recipe ideas.
Place thumbs, anus, scrotum, and testes in the freezer.
Information on local community services you may not know about.
A lot lizard is quite simply a prostitute who works truck stops and rest stops.
And health advice you can trust.
Lesbian humping with a man in the room running a camera and adding his man splash to the festivities can help prevent breast cancer.
Health and lifestyle on the Dazed and Convicted podcast at dazedandconvicted.com.
It's the
Dave.
Quarterly Women's
Social Club.
It's not on my phone.
Well, he
showed
from afar.
It's not on fucking my phone.
Now, the ball was in your court.
No, I fucking sent you a text back.
Yeah, but I never got it. What do you want me to tell you? I never got it.
And you call to confirm.
God, aren't you tired of this NPR feel-good radio wishy-washy, everyone learns something and feels great about it crap?
Not me. I get ones that want to fuck up their ass, and I like to do that.
What I present to you is chaos.
And I get ones who want to be slapped around a bit, and I do that too.
And you will laugh. It's a comedy show. It's a comedy show where you will actually laugh.
I would love to lick your pony vagina.
It's the Dave Quarterly Women's Social Club.
All right, well, to be blunt with you, I'm thinking that we should contact the police because it sounds like you have some really nasty situation going on.
I'm sorry?
We want to pray that two people we don't like get cancer.
Why would you pray for someone to get cancer?
Because we don't like them.
So if you hate podcasts and you're sick of all the shit that's out there, listen to my show, the Bi-Quarterly Women's Social Club. I'm the host, Chris Wilding. Facebook.com/biquarterly or bqwsc.com, where you can find out everything about us, listen to episodes, and get our live show schedule. Hope to see you there. Seacrest out.
Have a good night, motherfucker.
They're 12 miles of bad road, and now they have a microphone and their own show. It's the Daily Grindhouse Podcast, the official podcast of DailyGrindhouse.com. Starring G.
You tell that bitch who sent you here how sorry I am I can no longer be her friend.
And the man called Perry.
I'm the one that killed Mund and whooped Tuesday and put Wims in the hospital. Called up Thursday to tell Bob did not the birds spare the old son.
Reviewing the hits and the hidden from the world of exploitation, cinema, and beyond. Featuring exclusive cast and crew interviews. Past guests include John Carpenter, Robert Forster, Brian Trenchard-Smith, but still no Steve Guttenberg. we'll get him someday. We promise. I mean, we promise. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast, available on iTunes, Stitcher Smart Radio, Podomatic, and of course at dailygrindhouse.com/podcasts. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast, tough films for the rough crowd.
Got the goddamn message? Let's go to work.
You know, you worked in many areas before film. You know, it was music and dance and art and things like that. And how do you feel that those various disciplines, various things that you worked on, helped influence your work as a filmmaker?
Well, use the right word, discipline. You have to have discipline in all of them. If you want to have any fun and if you want to have any success, that's the most important thing. But I think, you know, your experience keeps developing, even though you might change what you're doing, or, you know, your point of view, it all comes from the very beginning and just keeps developing. So everything is influenced by everything you've been and everything you're going to be, actually.
You were in New York around the time of the underground film movement. Did you get to see much of that?
I saw quite a bit. You know, I saw a lot of Warhol's things. I had seen, when I was traveling with Ballet Russe, I had seen a lot in Los Angeles. I saw some of Pat Rocco's things, which were, you know, gay-oriented, and they were very, very softcore and very... not sophomore-ish, because they weren't, but they were like my films without the sex.
Do you feel that any of that underground art kind of influenced your own work?
Absolutely. I was very much into the art scene and participated and went to galleries quite often. And I went to see Pink Flamingos when it first opened, and I sort of kept up with things like that. And the Ridiculous Theater, Charles Ludlam. I liked avant-garde things, and I helped. If I liked them, I helped, you know, establish them by taking my friends who had never seen things like that. I took Michael Bennett and three other people to see Charles Ludlam's Bluebeard, which was brilliant, and tried to, you know, to support it in other ways other than just going and saying I liked it. You know, I tried to expand the audience by, you know, telling people and taking them there, and so that was my involvement, was basically as a spectator. When I made the film The Bible, I even talked to Charles Ludlam and Lola Pashlensky about being in it. I wanted them to be David and Bathsheba, and we had a long meeting about it. And in my loft, we sat and talked and drank tea and smoked grass and talked about it. And as it turned out, he wanted just total control. He said he'd love to do it, but he wanted control of everything, and I, at that point, I couldn't give it up. So, but he was, his whole theatrical company was excellent. I mean, they didn't do a bad show. Then I got into, like, Lip Synca this later, you know, in my life, Lip Synca, and I went to see her do, she lip synced the entire Joan Crawford movie, Harriet Craig, I think it was the name of the movie. I was just sat there with my mouth hanging open. First of all, that she could memorize that whole script and do it, you know, while they played the soundtrack, as well as do actions on stage. So it's quite a bit underground. It's well worthwhile and well looking into.
You were in New York in the late 1960s, and I was wondering if you remember when Stonewall happened and how maybe that affected you and your friends and people you knew.
I'll tell you, when Stonewall happened, I was in Maryland directing Mickey Rooney in George M. And in fact, that's the same time Judy Garland died. We were in rehearsal for it. And he even invited me to Judy's funeral, but I had so much to do, I couldn't leave, because I directed and choreographed the show. And we were, you know, getting ready to open, so Mickey left for the day, and... So I really missed the impact of being in New York when that happened, but I certainly didn't miss, you know, the undercurrent that happened after, you know, and the, it's not really undercurrent, because it was, well, I guess it might have been. It was very subtle at first, you know, after the big flare-up, and then it sort of like died down. A little bit later, someone blew on the embers, and it, you know, it really caught fire. I made Boys in the Sand as a direct result of that, because of the way I felt about gay people and the way they were treated, and I had never been in the closet, so I really can't say I came out when I put my name on the film, but I actually did. I think I'm probably one of the first 10 people to come out publicly, especially in the press. It definitely had an effect on me. I got tired of people, you know, not only looking down on the type of sex that we had, but they only did that, you know, at the front, because actually the straight people followed our lead, and they always have, you know, in fashion and in taste and in our little idiosyncrasies as far as sex is concerned. And right after the leather scene became very big, suddenly, you know, straight people were going down to the leather chest, and and buying harnesses and chaps and all sorts of sex toys. So it's very strange. It was a strange dichotomy that, you know, what we did in bed was not too good, but what we did, you know, socially was what they wanted to obtain for themselves. At least that's my take on it.
I was going to ask you on that, you know, why do you think it is that when you talk about, you know, various things of culture, it seems that there was that innovation, and it was that innovation as well with you with Boys in the Sand in some ways, that eventually it, you know, it crossed over into, I guess, straight or mainstream in some way. Why do you feel that a lot of this stuff did come out of, you know, gay culture or the gay community?
Well, I think the fact that I put good-looking men in a clean situation and a beautiful scenic locale, and I used people who really wanted to have sex with each other. I didn't say, you know, no, you fuck him and you do this. And I didn't ask you in the beginning if I could use four-letter words. But I didn't, you know, ask them or tell them to do specific things. And I didn't ever do that in any of my movies until much later when I needed things. But generally, I just matched them up in my head how I thought they would react to one another. First, I found out if they really were, you know, attracted to the person. And then I just let it happen. And I was like a voyeur standing there with the camera. I told someone recently that I never realized, but I was really participating because through the camera and the zoom lens, I could choose what I wanted to show, and so therefore I was a third participant in their sex act, because instead of, you know, going on the crotch, I might go up to someone's face and shoot what was happening with their expression and the ecstasy or the agony or whatever was there. You know, I was able to choose. And especially the first scene that I filmed with my lover and another person. And that's why it never affected me. You know, people said, how could you film your lover having sex with someone else? And I never realized it, but that's why, because I was actually participating. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was. And I let my eye just go where it wanted to go and didn't give too much thought to it, and let the people do what they wanted to do and captured it. And that's the thing that I think made it a crossover, is because there were two people being emotional with one another, and it wasn't just a sex act. There was something behind it, as well as the you know, the trappings and the dressings around it and the artsiness of it. And blatantly that way, but I did it on purpose to make it palatable for us. And I didn't make it for a straight audience. I made it for gay people, you know. But because of the intent, and gay people saw it and recognized that, it made it a success. And straight people were talking about it and coming to see it and standing in line. It was really amazing to me. I mean, my mouth is still open to this day at the success of that movie and the acceptance that it got. I will say it's been short-lived, because I always say once a pornographer, always a pornographer. Once it, you know, it goes back to me personally. They might like the film and what it does, but I get the brunt of it because I'm the pornographer. I'm the one who put it on film and put it out there for everyone to see. So that hasn't changed too much. You know. In making this documentary, we had a terrible time raising money because of, you know, the pornography element. We're still having trouble getting it shown at some festivals because of my reputation as a pornographer. And some people didn't even want to contribute to the film, even though they were good friends of mine. You know, they didn't want their name on the film, and they didn't want to participate in it in that way. So it's still there, but it, as far as being a crossover, it definitely was a crossover film. And Bijou, which was my second film, was equally as crossover. I had now the women's organization show Bijou, and they showed Bijou at the Designers Council Conference in Aspen. And I can't think of that guy's name, who's a critic, Brendan Gill. Brendan Gill wrote a whole article and did a lecture on Bijou and The Devil and Miss Jones, and using those two films as a subject matter. So it lasted for a good 2 years with me, you know. And of course, then I made my infamous Bible. So, but that again was the people who saw it talked about it, and others who didn't see it because they were shocked that I dare put the Bible in it to a pornographic film, but they didn't know that it wasn't a pornographic film. So, but it's funny. It goes in cycles, you know. I don't think they're making movies the way I made them anymore. It's become business, and gay for pay, and all those things have contributed to it, and they're very formulaic now. And there's still some people making movies with a little ambition to them and a little thought behind it.
I was curious about films before Boys in the Sand. It's kind of my understanding that you weren't really happy with what was being offered in terms of erotic film for gays at the time. What were those like?
Well, the only thing we got that was, I thought, erotic are you know, like Sean D'Amour and the really artistic experimental films. But as far as pornography goes, they were shot. They were called one-day wonders, and they would hire people and usually off of, you know, Sunset Boulevard or 8th Avenue or somewhere, and pay them $100 and put them with somebody else that maybe had done one before, and so it wouldn't be a total, you know, a loss in case something happened. But they just did it in some back room or did it in some toilet somewhere, or that's why they called them Blackfoot films. Or a black socks films, because they usually wore their socks. They didn't even take off their socks because the floors where they shot them were so dirty. It sounds very seedy, and it really was. But they made a lot of money, and they didn't do any, very little editing, and no music. They played it could be anywhere from rock and roll to, you know, jazz to even spiritual, so they didn't care. They just put on music to fill up the void. But they were really to masturbate to get you hot, and they weren't to make your brain think at all, your brain work. The first time I went out with some friends socially and sat in a theater and saw pornography, it was so bad, and we were all so bored, and because we were all friends, we weren't in the sexual mood, so we couldn't get off on that, so there was nothing else there for us. And that's when I said, you know, there's got to be something, you know, that we can do, or anybody can do, to make this more palatable and make it fun and make it, you know, pretty and make it make you feel good so you didn't feel sleazy, you know, when you left. And that's really why I made Boys in the Sand. I just wanted to experiment, see if it was possible, if it could be captured, you know, and not and maintained. Once the projector was off, if you could maintain something or hold on to something from the film, some feeling, and basically a feeling of I hate to say pride. That's a little too early for that, but not feeling sleazy and not feeling like you've done something bad and dirty.
Wanted to ask you about Casey Donovan and working with him, and also your friendship off the set.
Oh, Casey Donovan probably was one of the dearest people I think I ever met in my life. He was so contrary to, you know, to what he was. He was like two people. He was definitely a sex fiend. I mean, that I will go by. He loved his sex, but he was so clean cut. He was well educated. He was a school teacher at one point. One of the sweetest men I've ever known in my life, would do anything in the world for you. We had a very special relationship. And although I didn't call him and say, let's go to a movie, or it wasn't that kind of relationship. It was totally a professional relationship, except when we did work together, it was like we had known each other all our lives. And it seems like if I were in trouble and I needed some money, this is later on after, you know, this was like a couple of years after Boys in the Sand, and I needed some money and had to make a movie to get some cash flow coming, suddenly Cal would appear. And it wasn't because he heard I needed to make a movie, but he would just appear, and I'd say, hey, let's make another movie. And he'd say, okay. Or if then Cal were available, and he was doing a play in Los Angeles, he came down to see me in San Francisco, and I said, hey, I have to make a movie for some cash flow. Do you want to make another movie? He said, yes. So that's the way we sort of fell in, and we had one date. It's very funny. He called me up and he said, I think it's time we went out. And he had tickets to opening night for a play that Christopher Reeve was doing in New York at the Circle in the Square. And he said, I have opening night tickets and I want to take you. And I said, fine. So we went to see the play. And then we went to the opening night party afterwards. And, you know, all these big stars and things around. And Kate Burton was at our table. And it ended up, Cal and I were in the hallway with the busboys, having our cake and coffee out in the hallway with the busboys and the waiters. But it was a wonderful night. We had a great time together. But that was only our only official date. We spent time together at my house, in my apartment. And when he was going with Tom Tryon, and I was living in San Francisco, he called me and he said, you know, I've never asked anything from you, but he said, would you mind if I brought Tom over to your house and you showed him the movies? He's never seen the movies. And I said, no, not at all. And he brought Tom over, and I had the projector all set up and the film's all out. And I said, you know, you've got my house, and you go and you know how to work the projector, and you enjoy yourself. And I left them there the whole weekend, and they spent the weekend together at my house in San Francisco. And I took off for the baths and got up the next day and went to visit a friend. And when I came back, we had a nice dinner, and they left. So we had that kind of, you know, very casual relationship. And he would call me and say, well, I just made a film for Jerry Douglas, and you want to come, and we're going to do a screening. And so it's that kind of relationship. But working with him was unbelievable. I mean, just he knew what I wanted before I even said it. And it's like spoiled me, you know. That's why we work so well together. We were like one brain, you know, in two bodies. But I have nothing but good things to say about him. At the end, when he was heavy into meth, and he made a very ugly film. That's all, the only thing I can say about it. I had to turn it off halfway watching it. It was not easy to watch. And I think he died, I think like 6 weeks after I saw the film. But he came to see me like 2 weeks before he died. And he looked wonderful. I didn't even know he was sick. And because he looked so terrible in that movie that he did. And he knocked on my door, and I was living on 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue, and I had a nice little apartment. He knocked on my door, and I opened the door, and he came in, and he needed some money, so I gave him a couple $100s. And that was like 2 weeks later, I heard that he had passed. And on the way down to, down to South Florida, I was very upset by it, of course, but especially, you know, having seen him 2 weeks prior, and he didn't look like he was ravaged at all by the disease.
I was curious, we've talked a little bit about the differences between West Coast and East Coast, and the documentary focuses a lot on the reaction that Boys in the Sand had in New York. How did the film play in other regions?
It played just as well. I don't think it had the social impact in San Francisco or Los Angeles like it did in New York, because I wasn't there, and we didn't have I didn't have my... I had sort of a name in the theater because I'd been in the theater and done, I think, 8 to 10 Broadway shows and was choreographing and was Joe Layton's associate. And so I had a name among, you know, the theater people. I wasn't famous. People didn't know me if they, you know, if they weren't in the business. But everyone who was in the business knew my name, had either worked with me or heard about me. Or so that helped the porno sheet get going. Because suddenly, you know, Jerry Robbins heard, you know, there's a very funny story I'd love to tell, was Jerry Robbins called up Leonard Bernstein. Leonard Bernstein's manager told me this, and he said, "Lenny, you've got to go see this movie." He said, "It's just beautiful." He said, "And the music is wonderful, and it, believe it or not, it has a story." So I always got a big kick out of that, but we had, you know, celebrities come to see our movie, and of course we didn't put it in the paper like Deep Throat did when it opened a year after Boys in the Sand did. They had a press agent who really, you know, went for the throat and had someone taking pictures of Mike Nichols when he went in to see the movie, and then in the Daily News it would say Mike Nichols went to see Deep Throat, you know, last night. And I mean, all the power to them. You know, I wish we'd done it, but we didn't. But we had the same group, and I think Deep Throat could never have done what they did if we hadn't done what we did first. And they actually took our template, and they followed the same things that we did, and that's very simple. I just said to my partner when we decided we were going to make it into a feature-length film, then we're going to treat it with respect, and we're going to treat it like a real movie. We're going to have screenings. We're going to invite the critics. We're going to, you know, put it in a clean place. We're going to have ads. We're going to put ads in the paper, in the New York Times, and treat it like a real film and give it the respect that anybody would give their film. You know, is within our budget, within our means. And as I said before, because of my name in the theater, we did it at Christmas time. We released it 3 days after Christmas on the 28th of December. And there were, you know, theater parties and Christmas parties. And the word at those parties was, "Did you hear what Wakefield Poole did? You know, did you hear he made a dirty movie?" And blah, 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 blah. And that sort of spread, and people were curious. Mainly because, you know, they knew of my background in ballet and theater, and it really made it cross over. I don't take credit for that, except in our original concept of treating it like a real movie. And we did get reviewed. You know, we got reviewed by Variety and the New York Times, and it's the first time ever any pornographer has gotten a review of their film. And they weren't always the greatest. I remember one thing in Variety, the guy was trying to be subtly very nasty, you know, thinking he was going to, you know, hurt us, but he said the casting looked like it was done from Dial a Hustler. Well, that just, we put that in the paper as a tagline, you know, and that made people want to go see it. And it's a cinema verite. You think sometimes the camera's going to get into the action. I mean, we put quotes in the paper. We changed the quotes about every 4 days, and the people who caught on to it started looking for the ads just to see what our quote was for the week. So that helped. We kept sustaining that.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.